Okay, let's get started.
Wait, just a minute, partner.
No.
Guess again, freak boy.
To the Batmobile. Let's go.
AudioToYou.com. Another fresh picked pod from AudioToYou.com. Shutters Inc. with Charlton Muller.
Hi, and welcome to episode 59 of Shutters Inc. This is Bruce Williams from AudioToYou.com. With me on the line once again, Shelton Muller. How are you?
Hi, mate. Those numbers keep climbing, don't they?
They 59. Certainly do.
Oh, yeah, 59. That was the year the music died, wasn't it?
Oh, so it was.
Yep.
We can find an interesting anecdote for just about every episode number that there ever was.
Well, let me see. I'll have to think of one for 60. I've got a week to do that, so I'll come up with something. Yeah. I'm
for those
well,
who don't know what Shelton was referring to, it was the death of Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, and the Big Bopper in an aeroplane crash in North Dakota.
Ah, very good. Very good. I love a man who knows his trivia and history.
Interesting trivia question, though, is who was it that lost the toss of the coin for the third seat on the plane that Buddy Holly got?
Merle Haggard.
Was it?
Merle Haggard? I think it was Merle Haggard.
Okay. I always thought it was Waylon Jennings, It was one of those country singers. I know that, yeah. So there you go.
And he spent years in therapy, apparently, because the last thing he said to Buddy Holly was, I hope your plane crashes.
As a joke, obviously.
Obviously. And then within minutes, his plane had crashed. So,
oh, man.
Yeah, he saw him interviewed.
Wow.
And you might be right. It might be Waylon Jennings. No doubt one of our listeners will email us and tell us which one. Google the question and find out. But yeah, it was the last thing he said to Holly. And yeah, the plane crashed. Can you imagine that?
In retrospect, that was probably a pretty brave joke to drop given the weather at the time. It was a blizzard at the time. So
yeah.
Yeah, you know, I guess the chances of the plane crashing were a lot higher than under, say, normal circumstances. So
yes.
I can understand why he probably did spend a bit of time in therapy.
Well, it reminds us to never say things like that. Never make those your last words to anybody.
No.
You know? because you never know what you might say might come true. You know, I mean, you know, if you're jealous of somebody buying a new sports car, whatever you say, you know, don't say I hope you wrap it around a tree or anything like that, because chances are, you know, when I was in China in September, not last year, the year before,
right?
I got news via SMS that a young friend of our family had been killed in a car accident.
That's right.
And his name was Craig. He was 18. And the last thing that my brother-in-law said to him as he left home to drive and was consequently killed thereafter was, drive safely, mate. Which is a lot better than, you know, the opposite of that. But, and you think, boy, you never know, do you? You never know what, you know. So,
certainly
never
know
there we are.
Numbers up. Yeah.
No, that's true. You never know how the impact of your words can have on you and others.
Yeah.
And it's nice to know that the impact of our words on this podcast have had effect on the photography of our listeners.
Absolutely.
How's that for a segue?
Because
I just wanted to take this moment to apologize to listeners who think that I've ignored them by not answering their emails. I try to answer as many as I can, but I thought today what I'd do on the podcast, if that's okay with you, Bruce, is just answer a few of the emails, just a couple that I'm thinking of particularly that we've had and I haven't had chance to seriously address, but they make good subjects. So shall we just hoe into that?
Yeah, why not?
Fabulous. I just wanted to say hi to Walter, who lives in Kitchener, Ontario. He's originally, he says, from Newfoundland. And us Canadians, or me, I'm an ex-Canadian, we call them Newfies. And just, you know, for Australian listeners, a Newfie in Canada is like a Taswegian here in Australia.
Okay.
So, you know, they all, you know, they have two heads and club feet and, you know, all that kind of thing. But obviously you've moved to Ontario, Walt, because you just didn't fit into that demographic. So you've moved from Newfoundland. I noticed from your email that you're incredibly eloquent, so we understand why you moved, and I just thought I'd let you know. But you've asked an interesting question. Walt's only up to, well, as per his last email, he was only around episode 30, so I hope he's caught up.
Right.
But he talks about megapixels, and we've talked about this many times, you know, the pixel race.
Yep.
And cameras continue to build in terms of pixels. And but he asks an interesting question, because it's a valid point that he makes. Pixels are important, and we've talked about, you know, the value of pixels. If anybody wants to read an article I've written on the subject, go to our total-image.com.au website, because I've just posted an article on there about pixels. But his point is about cropping. Should we have more pixels to allow us to crop further? And of course, one of the reasons that photographers used to shoot in very large format film was that reason, that if you needed to crop, you still had the resolution in the image because you had a larger negative or transparency to work from. So it's a perfectly valid point. However, the difference between, say, a 6-megapixel and an 8-megapixel image that you've proposed here in your email, Walt, is probably not worth talking about. If you prefer a camera and its functions, or its the way it produces an image at 6 pixels, then a camera that has 8 megapixels, buy the 6-megapixel one, because the difference between 6 and 8 is not worth really talking about, even if you're cropping. But the difference between, say, 6 and 10 or 6 and 12 might be, you know, worth discussing. If you think of what we often refer to in Flash as the inverse square law, it still applies in pixels as well. I mean, you have to sort of quadruple your resolution, you know, your pixel rate, in order just to double your resolution. So you have to quadruple your pixels to just to double your resolution almost. So don't worry about the difference between 6 and 8, but 6 and 10, 6 and 12, that might be a completely different kettle of fish. But my question is, why do you want to crop? Now, if you want to crop because you didn't get close enough, or if you want to crop because you didn't compose correctly, then the lesson is, get close enough and compose correctly. Do it, you know, compose as best, you know, in camera as you can. Get your image, and we've often said this on the podcast, get your image right in camera before you get it into the computer. What we should try to aim for, really, as much as possible, is to take an image as we used to in film without thinking, oh, well, I'll do this in the computer. The problem with digital photography that has arisen is that everybody thinks that if you've got a digital camera, you need a computer. Well, when we shot on film, we didn't need computers. We just took our film down and we got it processed at the lab. We got our prints back, or our trannies back, and off we went. We've gotten into this mindset, and it's a great thing. I love the digital darkroom, but we shouldn't shoot with a view to always having to work our images. It would be great if we could say, go on, do a shoot, and then take that card down to a lab and print out directly from it without having to do a darn thing.
Do you think, though, that that's a fair analogy, given that back in the analog days, pro photographers would have, you know, tricks and things up their sleeve that they could do in the dark room to massage the images that they had got, you know, straight out of the camera?
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, Ansel Adams is the, you know, the keynote figure there.
Right.
In that he shot with a view to the dark room. And that's fine. But in the argument that I'm proposing about, say, cropping, for instance,
we shouldn't
have that mindset, or or exposure, or color saturation,
even things like,
and we're going to talk about this in a minute. We're going to talk about filtration in a minute. Even things like that, we should do as much as we can, even as people like Ansel Adams did, you know, in camera.
Yeah.
Ansel Adams would meter, you know, for a particular part of the scene, knowing that it would affect how everything else appeared in the negative. And then from that negative he would work. So he would use the zone system in his metering and in his darkroom work. But he was very keen to get it as close as possible to perfection in camera before he then moved to the darkroom. We do have a bit of a problem among photographers whereby we think, oh, well, you know, I'll shoot this now and fix it later. And cropping might be one of those things. Now, Walt, I'm not saying that's what you're doing, but I'd hate to think of any of our listeners thinking that I should buy more pixels so I can crop, when really, even if you do have a 10 or 12 or 17 megapixel SLR, crop in camera, you know. And the only thing that I would say we can't achieve is a different kind of cropping. If we're cropping for effect, for instance, we're doing a panorama, and we don't, you know, perhaps have the skills, or we didn't think of it at the time, or we don't have the you know, the capability of maybe stitching a panorama together. And we were talking about this before we started recording, and then you may want to, you know, do a panorama, and more pixels the better, but probably still best, you know, to stitch if you possibly can. And let me just mention a product that I've used recently, Serif, S-E-R-I-F is the brand, and it's Panorama Plus, and it's the best stitching program I've ever seen.
For the benefit of the listeners, you might be want to recount this this tale you were telling me before we started recording of this one that you've printed, because that's just awesome.
It is incredible. I did a Pito Lake panorama. If anybody's been to the Canadian Rockies and has stood and looked out over the vista that is Pito Lake, P-E-Y-T-O, Pito Lake, you'll understand that it is one of the most beautiful vistas on the planet. And I was there with my son just after the first snow of the season, and it was a beautiful blue sky. The air was crisp. There was no haze. It was just gorgeous. And I turned my camera vertical, and I took, you know, about 8 different photographs of it, and stitched them together using Serif Panorama Plus, and then printed this out as a 5-foot image. It's it printed out to 20 inches wide and 5 feet long.
Wow.
And yeah, and it's, I gave it to a friend who was a travel operator who helped me get to Canada at short notice, and he was absolutely stoked. I had it mounted and framed with non-reflective glass and gave it to him as a gift. Wow. And he loves it, and he's honored me by putting it into his living room. I didn't think he'd find room for it anywhere. In fact, I was worried he was going to say, where the hell am I going to put this, Shelton? Thanks, but mate, where am I going to put it? But he's actually taken pictures off his wall and put it in pride of place in his living room.
Wow.
But I walk up to it, on his wall, and I look for stitches. And we're talking pine trees, rocky mountain surfaces and textures, rocks, snow, and all of these things, and I can't see a stitch.
Beautiful.
And these are, it's sewn together 8 vertical JPEGs, and just did an incredible job of you know, stitching them together. So,
wow.
You know, if we're just on the subject of panoramas, it's awesome, awesome software, Serif Panorama Plus.
So am I to assume from that JPEG reference that you can't import your RAW files? You need to save them as a JPEG or a TIFF?
Or a TIFF, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
Right.
I can't, I may have actually used TIFFs, but I actually think I used JPEGs. I shot, in Canada, I shot RAW and JPEG simultaneously.
Oh, okay.
And, mm-hmm. Yeah, because the D200 can do that. And
why do you do that?
I'm sorry?
Why do you do that? Why do you save on both formats as you shoot?
Because the RAW is there should I need to seriously work the image, and of course you can do so without damaging the image as a 16-bit file, as you know, in RAW.
Yep.
But if the image is, you know, pretty good as it is, I've got a JPEG to work with, which is faster and easier.
Sure.
Also, if I'm emailing images or whatever, I've got to, you know, I haven't had to go through the whole process of getting the RAW, converting it down to 8-bit, and then, you know, saving it as a JPEG. The camera's already done that.
Yeah, right.
So it's just a matter of room on the hard drives, but I really, you know, I like to do that because JPEGs are so much easier to work with, and, you know, they're incredibly resilient. We often think of JPEGs as fragile things, but actually they're quite resilient. If you've got it, as we're talking, as, you know, correct in camera as possible. So,
yeah.
In the case of this panorama that I shot, I set the camera on manual. Every exposure was, you know, the same. I shot it about f8, f11. So it stitched together seamlessly, absolutely beautifully from the JPEGs. I didn't need to work the image that much because the scene itself was beautiful. I'd exposed correctly, and all I did was stitch them together and just use a bit of unsharp mask. That's all I did.
Right.
So, you know, but getting back to Walt's question, having more pixels was great because I turned the camera sideways to get that vertical resolution, the long side of the pixels,
mm-hmm.
And it has produced an image that I would compare to anyone who's shot with a Fuji 6x17. I really would.
Wow.
So, you know, it has its limits doing that kind of a panorama, but more pixels, the better. But if you wanted to crop, just getting back to your question, Walt, if you wanted to crop for effect, for instance, you might not like the format of your APS sensor or your sensor in your, you know, digital. You might not like the proportions of it, you know, width compared to length, which is usually sort of a 2-3 type, you know, ratio. You might prefer to make your image square, or you might want to make it, you know, slightly different. So for those reasons, if you're wanting to crop, that's fine. And the more pixels, the better. However, try, as I say, to get it right in camera as best possible. Also, just one note there, the more pixels, the better. Remember that the more pixels on your sensor, the more noise you often have in the image. So we need to get to a balance whereby it's noise versus, you know, pixels. Because if you have noise, then your pixels are useless, because the noise is just these randomly colored pixels that actually take away detail from your image rather than enhance it. There's always a balance. There's always some sort of place where one will fight off the other, and, you know, we're going to get to that point very soon, unless the technology of heat exchange between photo sites gets better.
So just on that, if you know, in the menu for your digital SLR, you have a choice of shooting at three different resolutions.
Mm.
If you shoot at a lower resolution, does that mean that the signal-to-noise ratio is improved?
That's a very good question. I wouldn't have a clue, to be quite honest with you.
Yeah, right.
That's a very good question.
And next time you're talking to one of the camera manufacturers, as I know you do on occasion, maybe ask someone.
Yeah, I'll make a note of that. Yes, okay. Because it's an interesting question. I would never recommend we shoot at lower resolutions, because you never know what that image is going to be used for.
Yeah.
But technically, it is an interesting question.
Yeah.
Okay. I always shoot at my highest resolution, no matter what it is.
Yeah.
You know, if someone says, "Look, can you come and shoot for our website?" I still shoot at the highest resolution, because my client may want to use those images for other things.
But, well, I'll tell you what, since you did the podcast way, way, way back when, talking about RAW, I just shoot exclusively in RAW now.
Really?
I know it increases my workflow, but I just love the flexibility.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and the fact that you can set your black point and your white point, you know, in levels without damaging the image is, you know, I mean, that's a standard thing we do in Photoshop, is set the black point, set the white point in levels. I do that for pretty well every image. You know, if you can do that in a 16-bit file and it doesn't alter the quality, then, you know, that's just fabulous. So, you know, I very rarely shoot in... the only thing I shoot in JPEG, to be honest with you, is a wedding.
Is that for the speed of writing the data?
Yeah, speed of writing and also speed of working thereafter. I tend to spend a lot of time in post-processing on a wedding, because you're doing things like blur, you know, Gaussian blur, you're retouching faces, you're doing those kinds of things. I mean, I still stand to, you know, I've been shooting weddings on film for a very long time, so I still stand up by saying, you know, shoot it, get it right in camera, and I do. But, you know, I know that there are certain things I'm going to want to do because I can. You know, in the image, and that could be black and white or Gaussian blur or whatever it is I might need to do. And just working with a JPEG when you've got hundreds of images to process is, you know, my workflow in weddings. Otherwise, I'm with you. I shoot everything RAW. But the great thing about the D200 is that it produces a JPEG simultaneously if I want it to.
Sure.
And, you know, I do both, which is, you know, great. So I hope that answers your question, Walt. And, you know, perhaps any of those who are caught up in the pixel race, because it's a commercial thing. It's being thrust at us.
It's just marketing hype.
It is marketing hype. And it only when you get to a certain level of pixels are you actually seeing a visible difference, or benefiting maybe from a visible difference. Whether you'll see the difference in a 6x4 or 5x7 or even 8x10 between 6x8 or 6x10 or 6x12 is probably doubtful. But you have them and you can use them. You know, that's, if you have the extra pixels and you can use them, great. But let's remember that, and I'd suggest you have a look at this article on the Total Image website, because it's, you know, as one comment has said, it's probably one of the most balanced articles he's read on the subject. So, you know, from that perspective, which is a compliment to me, thank you very much, it just sort of balances things out just a little bit.
And as we've said a lot in the past as well, of far more importance is the quality of the optics and the quality of the sensor.
Yep, absolutely. And your exposure, you know, and
far more
like
than
that.
How many megapixels you've got.
How many pixels you've got. Yeah, let us remember that, you know, we had the D1 came out in 99 with 3.1 or 3.2 pixels or something. And it was
megapixels.
Megapixels, yeah. So, yeah, we didn't have one
3.2
pixel.
3.2 pixels.
Yeah. That's high resolution image of that. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Finger painting at kindergarten.
Yes. Here's my tree. Let's not get caught up in that. But by all means, for the sake of cropping, an excellent idea. Another question that has been posed at us, and I'll briefly talk about this too, if we have the time. Do we have the time,
yeah,
Bruce?
Yeah, for sure.
All right, we've got the time. Brad, thank you for your email. Brad's from Milwaukee in Wisconsin, and he tells us that he enjoys our podcast. I wanted to talk about filters. Now, we have talked about filters on our podcasts before, but he asks some specific questions, so let's talk about it again, because we're sort of on the same subject. We're on the subject of getting it right in camera. Now, we've handled the idea of cropping, and, you know, for composition or, you know, closeness or whatever. And in the same vein, we really need to talk about filters, because we want to get it right in camera. Recently, the Australian importer of Kokan filters here, which is Maxwell, asked me if I had any images whereby I had, you know, benefited from the use of filters when I was in the Rockies in Canada. And I sent them two images that I'll send to you, Bruce,
right.
Of a waterfall and a mountain. I think it's the Athabasca Falls or the Sun Walk.
This was the neutral density filter.
The neutral density. Uh-huh. Have you seen the images?
The graduated ND, yeah.
Yes. Have I posted them before, have I?
Well, it was that shot that you sent to me when I said to you, we were talking a few eps back about the difference between the D100 and the D200 straight out of the camera, and I said, oh, there can't be that much difference. And I asked you to send me an image that both you and your son had shot, and, and I think it was this shot that you sent to me.
Right.
Same set of falls that we're talking about.
Yeah, well, we photographed so many waterfalls, it's hard to, you know. But I think these were the Athabasca or the Sun Wapta Falls. I can't remember which of them, and I should have made notes, but I'm shocking at doing that. I will send you the picture that is, or two pictures, and I'd appreciate it if everybody go to audiotu.com and have a look at them.
Sure.
Because one uses the gradual neutral density, or Grey 2, as Kogan call it, and the other one doesn't. And the difference between the two images is incredible. I sent these images off to Maxwell because they needed some for an advertisement that they're running here in Australia in magazines for Kokan filters. And I got an email back from the CEO, John Swainson, who said, man, do you know how to sell a concept? Because the difference between these two images basically screams at you and says, you need the Kokan graduated G2. Because if you don't have one of these, you ain't going to be able to shoot landscapes like this. And it is that easy. Now, admittedly, these graduated filters are, you know, unnecessary from the point of view that you could just simply take two pictures and then merge them in Photoshop, you know, and use the exposure from one and the exposure from the other, and you can do that, which is fine if you don't have any filters. But we're talking about getting it right in the camera, and I think photographers still need to strive to that end. And anything you can't do in camera, we've got other tools to fix now, but we should get it right in camera. And without these grad filters in Canada, I would have been lost or spent a heck of a lot of time, you know, in post, you know, and also in shoot, because I've got to take two images. I've got to make sure that, you know, my exposure, but I've got to expose for one and then expose for the other, make sure that there's enough balance so when I merge the images, blah, 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 they segue seamlessly between the two. You know, there's all that kind of thing that I'd have to consider.
And it would mean you would also have to set up a tripod to do those shots where you, if you've got the filter, you can just do a handheld shot and be done with it.
If you can, I mean, I did use a tripod because I set up the exposure so it gave me a little bit of movement in the water, which, you know, you like to do just to sort of create that effect. But you're absolutely right. I could have handheld it and still achieved the same kind of benefit. So, you know, Brad, yes, definitely if you're a landscape shooter, you have to buy a series of grads. Now, you should get if you can, a neutral density grad. Koken don't make a neutral density grad. What they call it is a gray. I haven't really noticed any color shift, and it doesn't really worry me because I'm not one of these purist natural, you know, or landscape photographers. But there are filters made by Sing Ray. Galen Rowell, before his sad demise, he started to produce a series of filters for the landscape shooter that are perfectly neutral density, and the graduations between them, you know, between different kinds of filters are varied. And, you know, so if you were the consummate landscape photographer, these are the kinds of filters that I'd suggest you get. Of course, you also talk about which brands of filters, and I'll move on to other kinds of filters in a moment, but I use the Koken simply because it's an affordable system, and it's a slot system wherein, you know, your filters can move up and down within a filter holder that fits onto the front of your lens. You talk about the fact that you have many different size diameters, different diameters over your lenses. Well, the Koken filter system accomplishes that, especially if you get the P-series filters. They have a larger system as well, but the P-series would probably do you fine. They're large enough filters. The adapter is large enough to go over, you know, I think up to 77 mil, and it can go right down to 49 or even smaller. So
I thought it went to 82, actually.
It might actually go to 82. There's not many 82 size diameters around, but you might be right. I can't see why it wouldn't, but you basically use one adapter, if that's all you want to do, to fit onto, you know, different size diameter lenses, and the one filter then supplies all. So really, that's the kind of filter that I'd suggest you look at. If you've got, you know, different diameters in your lenses. Otherwise, you're buying one polarizer for one lens and one polarizer for another lens. And the thing about graduated filters, too, if they're that slot-type system that the Koken is, you can actually move the filter to match where in your composition, you know, you need to stop the graduation.
Right.
So, you know, and of course, other mandatory filters I would suggest definitely would be a polarizer. We should never be without a polarizer. To blue up those skies, to, you know, remove reflections from, say, rainforest-style photography.
To let you see through the water.
Let you see through the water, yeah, if you're doing, you know, beautiful tropical water, you know, water scenes, and you can do some awesome stuff with a polarizer. So, you know, most definitely would I suggest that, you know, you have one of those. Another one would be a neutral density, just a straight neutral density filter, which just darkens everything. Now, sometimes you're in a very bright situation and you don't want that much depth of field. A neutral density filter will accomplish that for you. No matter how low you set your ISO, you know, you still can't work at 2.8 or 1.8 that you want to. And so, you know, a neutral density filter will help you there. Not only that, but if you wanted to do a time exposure in a very bright circumstance, a neutral density filter will allow you to do that. So I'd suggest
I've actually just bought myself a set. So I've got an ND2, an ND4, and an ND8.
Yes, great. And you'll use them for those kinds of things.
Oh, yeah.
If you could only, if you only could afford one, I'd suggest the ND8. You know, may as well go the whole hog, which is a three-stop neutral density. That would probably be the one you'll use the most, I would suggest. You know, Bruce.
But, yeah, absolutely. It is. It's probably the only one I've used so far.
Yeah.
And there have even been times where I've put the ND8 on and gone, Jesus, I wish I had an ND16. But I just don't know if the autofocus would be able to see through it.
Switch to manual. Yeah. Switch to manual. But yeah, that would be another filter that I would definitely have. And then, of course, every filter system has its quirky little filters. Like, I've spoken about the Koken blue-yellow polarizer many times on the podcast. I love that filter, you know, for landscape work. It's just awesome.
Yeah.
And I've used it, you know, all over the world. So I love that filter. So definitely there are filters that we should have. Even things like diffusion filters. I know there are some beautiful processes in Photoshop like Gaussian blur and diffuse glow and those kinds of things. But a nice, you know, diffusion filter like the Koken Diffuser 1 is a lovely filter. There are some beautiful, Hasselblad used to make a beautiful diffusing filter that, you know,
what are your
gorgeous.
Thoughts on UV filters? Are they worth the effort?
I don't see really any difference between the image when it's on and when it's off.
Yeah.
To me, they're an insurance yeah, you know, against I have damaged lenses, a couple of lenses, irreparably, you know, because I've accidentally gone clung on something and not had a filter. I'm just a bit of an oaf. So yeah, they're an insurance, you know, and it's better, you know, every time you apply a cloth or a lens tissue to your lens, you are wearing it down. There's very, very fragile coatings on lenses.
Right.
I would rather clean a filter than a lens.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that, for that filter, I would definitely say, I mean, Kokin do have a slot type UV, but you know, why? You know, you may as well, you know, it's no, you buy the screw type, stick it on there, keep it on there.
Yeah.
But other filters, I'm a fan of the slot filter systems that are available.
Yeah.
Kokin is the most popular here in Australia. I know it's very popular in other parts of the world. In America, because you have 300 million people there, you have, you know, there are more people who can compete and survive. And I know there are other slot type systems there, such as more expensive systems like the Singray system, which is very difficult to get here. But you know, that kind of filter system, Brad, will, as you say, it helps you to avoid the problems of having different diameters. They're easier to carry around because they're not in a metal ring. They're just slot, you know, they're plates. And you can use more than one. You know, you can stack them on top of each other. So you can use a polarizer and a grad. You can use a polarizer and a neutral density. You can, you know, swap them around without too much hassle, or use more than one filter without too much hassle. So it's all part of getting that image right in camera. And I'm a big believer in filters for that very purpose. And I'll post up the images that I've sent off to the people here to use in the ad. And you'll see why, you know, they tell the story that they do, because the difference between the two is remarkable. And I have not, and I'll say this categorically, I have not done anything in Photoshop that would make you see that difference more dramatically. These are the images as they have been, you know, produced
straight
out of the camera by using the filters. So I hope you see the benefit of them, and you know, understand that we still, as photographers, should endeavor to get our images right in camera. And filters and pixels and your cropping and composing and all those things are part of that process. And whatever we need to do after that should be as a result of the fact that we can't do that in camera, or maybe we just forgot at the time. But, you know, we should nonetheless strive to compose our images, crop our images, filter our images, expose our images, you know, all of those things that we do in camera as best possible. It's our lesson to us as photographers, and it keeps us on our toes. The moment we start getting slack by thinking, oh, well, look, whatever I forget now, I can fix later, is just detrimental to our process as photographers.
Yeah.
And it's a fairly important thing to me.
I think if I could say one other thing about the cropping thing from the first question you answered, is if you have a feeling that you might want to crop it, then take two shots.
Mm.
You know, do a crop in camera, but then take a wider shot to give you the flexibility if you got it wrong.
True, because you can. You know, it's, I absolutely would, you know, I thoroughly concur with that, Doctor. Absolutely. Thoroughly concur. So I hope that answers some of our questions, Brad and Walt. Particularly, thank you for sending those questions through. And, you know, please, now that we're back on air, if you're listening and you got a question, please send it to us, because in the case of Brad and Walt here, they provided the basis for this podcast. Because sometimes I get a couple of emails that, you know, such as these today, that are basically in some way asking the same question, although dealing with two completely different things. They come back to the same kinds of issues and help us to put together an episode that benefits a lot of people, hopefully. So thank you again very much for being interactive with us.
Absolutely. All right, matey. Well, thank you very much for all of that.
My pleasure. Absolutely.
Still no word from the GorillaPod guy. I've sent him another email. I'm just awaiting a reply. So
okay.
If I haven't heard anything by the time we come to record next week, then Shelton, mm-hmm. I might get you to chase up your Australian contact and see if we can't organise something from this end.
No worries. Absolutely.
So, really disappointed with this. Anyway. All right, mate. Well, thank you for that.
Thank you.
And we will talk with you again next week.
Another 168 hours from now. Absolutely. I live for the day.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right, mate. Take care.
You too, mate.
See ya.
Bye.
You've been listening to another Fresh Picked Pod from audiotoyou.com. Audio to You delivers the best quality podcasts direct to your desktop or portable.
You be the boss.
Hear what you want to hear.
When you want to hear it.
Hey, now that's a good idea.
AudioToYou.com. Hit us today.
And remember,
Control D to bookmark.
AudioToYou.com.